So this was a study on the combined use of alcohol and energy drinks, and what we looked at was the how the combination led to potential increased drinking and driving versus just the use of alcohol only. Go on to the next one. So this is an emerging public health issue. There actually was another study that came out from the University of Florida where they went to the bars and they examined bar patrons' perceptions and their actual behaviors. What distinguishes this study from any others that have ever been done is we actually look at the drinker's perception of, is there a difference between driving over the 0.08 legal limit and driving when drunk. And as I get to the results later, people do see a difference in, well, you know, I'm a little buzzed and I'm probably over the 0.08, but I'm not drunk. And so what the law says is drunk and what drivers say is drunk is still different. The combined users in this sample is college students. I don't know if they're rebellious or what, but the energy drink users tended to drive drunk more, or over the 0.08 legal limit more than alcohol-only users. I've been researching energy drinks for 8 years now, done numerous studies, and it's still, you know, the reason this is a emerging public health issue is because we don't really have enough data yet, because energy drinks didn't come to the U.S. till 1997. So it's a little bit different. We're just now getting in that first wave of, well, probably the last 3 years, we got in that first wave of actual college students that had access to energy drinks when they were younger kids growing up. There's a thing, a special on Good Morning America yesterday about how kids shouldn't be shouldn't be drinking energy drinks at all, and I've been publishing on that since 2010 with the SUNY Youth Sport Institute about addictive behaviors and how consuming the energy drinks, not just the caffeine. One of the things a message that I would like to get out that's not in my presentation is a lot of the research focuses solely on caffeine, whereas a lot of the other ingredients in the over 500 brands that exist, they have dangers as well. So, especially some of the more exotic compounds like evadamine, which is it's kind of like, I was going to say, what was the substance that got banned 2 years ago? Ephedrine. It's similar to ephedrine, but it's stronger. It just hasn't got banned yet. So there, you know, that's where we're at with nutritional supplements, and as you all probably know, energy drinks are still considered supplements, not actual drinks. So that's another thing. Just for some numbers, real quick, Red Bull sales alone went up 1 billion cans, went to 1 billion cans in 2000, and over 3 billion in 2006. In 2006, we broke 500 new brands on the market, and two of the drinks that have the evadamine substance I was telling you about are Spike Shooter and Redline. I have a picture here of a 6-year-old boy who is sponsored by Monster Energy Drink. Now, this picture is actually 3 years old now, but you think about the USA Today thing just had, or Good Morning America just had, kids shouldn't be drinking energy drinks, but the companies have certainly targeted youth populations, and as I was saying earlier, this would be the first time where we hit that group that used as kids that are now in college. All right, so the problem. College students have exhibited that they really like mixing energy drinks with alcohol, whether it be perceptions that it reduces intoxication or even the feeling, just the pharmacology or the pharmacokinetics of how the substances work in combination with alcohol. For example, taurine when mixed with alcohol, a person can actually get drunk faster because it's synergistic. Both of them attach to the GABA receptors, so you can get drunk faster. Now, people perceive because of the stimulants that balances it. But the reason, most people don't know it, but when you look at the science behind why is taurine really in energy drinks, taurine helps you from getting the jitters and it helps you from getting irregular heartbeats. So it's a protective substance for the heart. So let's say you have 8 Red Bulls, it helps you from having irregular heartbeats and things. So that's one of the reasons that taurine's in there. For example, if someone goes to the hospital and they're overdosing on stimulants, they took too much cocaine, they'll give them an IV with a taurine drip to help stabilize their heart. So, that's why energy drinks have a high level of taurine in them. Just something to throw out there. In 2010, the FDA banned the sale of pre-mixed alcoholic energy drinks. They didn't ban adding the taurine, but caffeine was taken out. Again, the focus was mostly on caffeine. I lived in Oklahoma at the time, and I was on the FDA panel, which banned the 4 Loko. Anybody remember 4 Loko? It's called Blackout in a Can. We had college kids were at college parties, instead of playing beer pong, they were playing that with 4 Loko. And one can of that, one 16-ounce can of that was equivalent to your binge drinking of 4 or 5 drinks, alcoholic drinks in one can, and about 3 energy drinks. So it's kind of a bad thing. Yeah. Have you all heard of RBVs and Jaeger bombs and Vegas bombs, Red Bull vodka, all the cool names to make it trendy. So those are still, legally sold in bars. Even though, we've banned the pre-mixed alcoholic energy drinks, you can still drink, you can still go to a bar and get all the Red Bull vodkas, or you can still mix all the energy drinks you want. And there's even some energy drinks out there now called dopamine, like they're actually marketing, and they there's one called cocaine, that one it's been on the market. What it's kind of like with other supplements, how they switch it. Whenever one gets banned, they just go to the next one, get another one. But the purpose of this study, the main one, was to compare alcohol consumption patterns with students who used alcohol only to those who combined alcohol with energy drinks. And like I was saying earlier, the big difference in this one is we looked at, is there a perceptual difference between driving over the 0.08 legal limit and driving what they would consider drunk? We did find that a lot of students don't understand how many drinks they could really have to be over the 0.08. So, the data shows that they think that that's like 5 drinks. I'm still probably at the 0.08. What they did, an interesting future study would be to actually have the if you guys all ever seen the blood alcohol content, portable things you can just blow. They're actually surprisingly accurate. That'd be something that researchers in here could analyze, and you could even give it, it's like $20 I think to buy those online, but and we didn't do that in our study, but that would be something to add to this on their perceptions, because it really seemed like they weren't aware what 0.08 really would be. So anyway, we used chi-square analysis and Mann-Whitney U-test to examine differences between the groups. The alcohol-only group in this study had 174. The combined use was 107. We actually have a follow-up study on this with about 650 in it, so we have a bigger follow-up study. And between the time of submitting this and this presentation, this study's actually been published now and substance use and misuse. So I'll give that to some people later if you want to email me. But it's that was published this month in November for the full methods and all that. So respondents were categorized according to whether they had driven or not driven under the influence of alcohol within the past 30 days. Like some of the other studies here, our study also looked at 30-day drinking patterns. To examine the instrument, we did a two-week interval test retest. And the instrument was found to be reliable at 0.92, so good internal consistency for a 30-day drinking questionnaire. So what we found, here's the results. Combined users were significantly more likely to drive both over the 0.08 BAC and after knowing they're too drunk to drive. And you see here within the combined use group over the 0.08, it was 53% drove versus alcohol only at 38%. For too drunk, it was 57% versus 44%. So it's not as big of a difference as I had expected originally, but that's when I went back to looking at the numbers. I'll get to that, the quantity and frequency numbers later. It seems as if they don't understand what that is because of an average number of drinks consumed. So the chi-square results indicated that 57% of combined users, they reported choosing to drive, and that's an important thing. It's not that they didn't know that they probably shouldn't be driving, but they chose. Their perception, well, I'm good, though. You know, I'm not, I can drive. You know, so they chose to drive while knowingly too drunk versus 44%. And that, you know, that would make sense in terms of, you know, one of the known side effects of stimulants is, you know, with increased dopamine, you feel like, you know, kind of more indestructible, higher confidence. In studies, other studies that I've done, one of the main factors of why somebody uses energy drinks is to increase their confidence in order to talk to other people, to be more social. So if somebody isn't as out, you know, somewhat similar to alcohol, you know, people, if they're a little shy, they might use alcohol to be more talkative. Well, one of the problems with that, though, is what happens when you drink? You kind of get kind of dumber. So, you know, they think, well, you know, I don't want to look dumb, so I'm going to drink some energy drink with it. Other patterns that trends, you know, there's a self-reporting part where they can write in answers. Another trend, you know, this wasn't just, unlike other studies, we also examined, it's any energy drink use within a two-hour period, so it's not uncommon because of the cost, they're very expensive, it's particularly in bars. College students will chug two right before they go in, or if they got too drunk at the end of the night or in the middle of the night, then they would just go and order a Red Bull and just drink that to kind of try to balance themselves back out and try to get back to the level. Like they're like, oh, I'm beyond that curve. I'm a little too drunk. Let me go get a Red Bull and try to give me a little pick-me-up, you know, which is better than some of the alternatives out there. So, as you know. Past 30-day differences in the number of days driven while drunk were also examined. Results indicated combined users drove more frequently, with 11.6% of combined users driving 3 to 7 days, three to seven or more days, while drunk compared to 2.8% of alcohol-only consumers. So that's a really big finding there. That's something important to think of or to take with you. Because that's just the risk factor of the number of times. You know, we found that the majority of drinkers have driven at some point over 0.08, where they perceived that I probably shouldn't have drove that time. But the frequency of, you know, you'll notice here, the combined users, when you go to 3 to 4 days, it's 5.8% versus 2.3%. And then over 5 days, the combined users were they were the only group that did that. So the students who drank alcohol only, they didn't drive more than five times in the past 30 days. Now, if we extended this, we also had, you know, had they done it in their lifetime and in the past year, those numbers are higher. But we didn't have the drinking data to compare, you know, how many days they drank and all that, so we didn't include that. Another important finding, combined users are also more likely to choose to ride with an intoxicated driver while knowing it was unsafe. So again, that's just, you know, important because they knew this person's too drunk to drive, and this is not just over the legal limit. This is what they considered, they're definitely too drunk to drive. They're not on the borderline. And that was 56% for combined users versus 35% for alcohol only. So we also looked at the amount of alcohol consumed, the days drunk, binge drinking episodes, greatest number of drinks on one occasion. And for each of these quantity frequency variables, the combined use group had higher mean ranks or higher average scores. We look here in the alcohol only group, average number of alcoholic drinks, the alcohol only was 3.5 per occasion versus 5.42 for the combined use group. The number of days drunk in the past 30, 1.3 for alcohol only versus 3.5 on average for the combined use. Binge drinking, same thing, 1.61 compared to 4.08. Greatest number of drinks, and you know, this is a big one here, the average is 4.62 for alcohol only versus 8, so that, you know, the combined users, and it's not just that they're mixing it, a lot of, you know, it could just be that combined users are a riskier group anyway, you know, and it's something to remember that they're not, you're in that group whether or not you did that every single time. You know, a lot of combined users, there's nothing necessarily that says that they combined every single time that they went out drinking, but they did that in the past 30 days. So that's another consideration. Discussion and conclusion. So other researchers have also found that college students who use energy drinks are more likely to drink and drive and ride with an intoxicated driver. And that main study was alcohol mixed with energy drink study out of Florida. The current study suggests students who combine alcohol with energy drinks exhibit increased likelihoods to drive over the 0.08 limit, choose to drive while knowingly drunk, choose to ride with an intoxicated driver, and to consume more alcohol and participate in riskier patterns. Just my final slide here before I go over the time by too much. We got 2 minutes? Okay. Effective prevention programs need to focus on the individual's positive motivations and reasons for using alcohol. I mentioned some of those earlier, you know, to be more social. In other energy drink studies, I have a poster here actually at 12:30. Is that right? 12:30. And that's on just energy drink use alone, looking at how that is related to prescription stimulant use, and we really hit the motivation, positive motivations on that, where we're looking at, you know, and the biggest one among college students is the perception that it'll help them study and make them smarter, and that, you know, so I don't know how many people in here are teachers, but it's a common thing in a college class in particular to see them come in with energy drinks, and that doesn't stop in the classroom. Like, you know, some of these I remember when I was, when I first started doing these studies, I had students who would have 5 or 6 a day. It's not as common anymore, but back in 2007, students were really getting on them. Evidence from studies, motivational interviewing and addiction studies show that the use of scare tactics and fear of health consequences has not been effective in long-term prevention efforts. So, you know, really focus on trying to figure out what are the reasons they're using these, what are their perceived positive reasons, even though you know, I say that word perceived because they're probably not positive reasons, but what they perceive as a positive might not match up. And then try to use those perceived positive motivations in a non-judgmental, understanding way. So a little quote here, we must first seek to understand before seeking to understood. So, you know, try not to preach on those messages, but try to be understanding that, you know, these are marketed, you know, similar to, let's say, the vaporized cigarettes, right, the e-cigarettes, right? It's kind of energy drinks in the same category where they took the stage by storm. All right. Out of time.